Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Chris Alexander is here. He's the Director of Engineering for Crawford Broadcasting. And not often do you get to spend an hour with a company's Director of Engineering to ask about broadcast challenges, solutions, and so forth. Chris Alexander coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb right there at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, delighted to be here and glad you can join us on this beautiful spring day, beautiful across a lot of the U.S. here in Nashville, where I am. It's a beautiful sunny day, absolutely gorgeous. We're going to try to build a little fire outside in the fire pit this evening. So we're going to try to get that done here. Sorry about my voice. I'm a little under the weather. I caught a cold about 4 days ago, and I'm almost over it, but not quite. Hey, I'm in the Telos Alliance studio here in Nashville, Tennessee. Big thanks to my employer, the folks at the Telos Alliance, who give me a couple hours every Thursday to work on and produce This Week in Radio Tech and bring it to you. And of course, I would encourage you to check out my employer's website at telosalliance.com. We got new stuff coming out all the time. I've been playing with the new software audio consoles that are fully in software, fully server-based. I've got a server here, an old Dell R710 that's running six audio consoles on it, and you access them all with a beautiful HTML graphical user interface. It's just gorgeous. We've got some videos up on the website about that. And now we've got a phone system. The VX phone system is now fully integrated into a Docker container, and you can install that. And by the way, just to see how small of a PC I could put an audio console on, I have an old Dell Optiplex 755, and you can buy them all day long on eBay for $50. $50 with a Core 2 Duo, you know, an old Dell, and wipe out Windows, put Ubuntu 20.04 on it, and install an audio console from Telos Alliance. It is so cool. And it just sits there and runs. I think I got 24 faders on it. 24 faders. Okay, enough about all that. Anyway, I really appreciate Telos Alliance for providing me full-time employment and also for giving me lots of toys to play with and tell you about. All right, enough about all that. I want to bring in Chris Alexander. Chris is the Director of Engineering for Crawford Broadcasting. And Chris, welcome into the show. Glad you're here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That you're in an interesting looking place. That doesn't look like your normal office. Tell me where you're at.
No, I'm. you caught me. You caught me at our cabin up in the High Rockies here. So we hide out a lot up here. Really year round, but especially once we get into the warmer months, we hide out here a lot. Like
really?
3 days a week.
Yeah. Really? What kind of elevation are you at there?
About 8,600 feet right here. And I'm looking out the window and the Continental Divide is just right over there. You know, I couldn't quite throw a rock that far, but it's not far.
And what kind of elevation is the Continental Divide, at least that part of it?
Oh, it's 12,000 plus right there.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Snow cap, beautiful. Just,
that's a, I
think a great place.
8,600 feet where you're at sounds like oxygen, supplemental oxygen area to me. But you used to it?
We moved here from Texas, 600 feet AMSL, 22 years ago. And it took us a couple of years, but we've definitely acclimated to it. And since we spend so much time up here, we don't even notice it anymore.
Hey, we're going to get into some cool technical discussions, including studio infrastructure overhauls. We're going to focus on co-locating AM transmitters, since a lot of AM stations are finding out that their transmitter site, the property, is now worth more than the radio station. That's happened in a couple of big markets. Some big stations have found that out, and they've had to go co-locate or move. So you're kind of an expert at that. We're also going to talk about MDCL. That's an interesting topic. And also dealing with telco abandonment of legacy services, including abandoning POTS. So you're hands-on. You got some real-world stuff. And you also, well, we'll talk about it later, but Chris puts out this local oscillator newsletter, which has just the best minds in broadcast engineering, speaking on real-world problems, issues, and challenges and how they fix them. And that gets put out every month. And I got to give a little prop here to two different people. And I know these are kind of competing magazines here, competing publications. Chris is the editor of Radio World's Engineering Extra. Do I have that right, Chris? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm the technical editor of Radio World's
Engineering Extra. Right. Technical editor of Radio World. And so one of the cool things about Engineering Extra, of course, is it's just engineering stuff. Now, at the same time, I need to talk about these guys at Radio Guide. Radio Guide is also technical articles, and Radio Guide's articles tend to be a little bit longer. They tend to go in depth a bit more, but you'll find great articles on engineering in both of these publications, Radio World Engineering Extra and Radio Guide. And I need to tell you that you can find Radio Guide at radio-guide.com on the interwebs. So appreciate Ray Topp, and I appreciate Chris Alexander coming on to talk with us about these things. Okay. Got that out of the way. Chris, we got a few minutes before we need to take our first break. Let's see. Gosh, there's so many things we could chat about. I guess why don't we tee off this topic of co-locating AM stations, and we'll kind of tee it up here for a couple of minutes to find out, first of all, the why. What precipitates, what happens that makes people say, we're going to put these two AM stations together?
Well, it can be any number of things. You mentioned one of them is that you find out that your transmitter site property is worth more, than the radio station. That's pretty compelling. It's pretty hard to ignore, especially when, you've got a struggling AM a lot of times that really doesn't have much cash flow, and it's really hard to justify keeping it on that dirt that's really worth a lot more. Another thing that happens a lot is you lose your lease. For whatever reason, maybe you don't own the property, maybe the landlord owns the property, and they decide that this dirt's worth a whole lot more for an Amazon warehouse than it is for a broadcast tenant that's not paying anywhere near as much as they would be. So that happens sometimes, and there can be all kinds of other precipitating events, but I think those are probably the biggest ones right there.
So many AM transmitter sites are where they physically are because they have to physically be there for proper spacing and so forth. So, if let's imagine you're a radio station and you're come to find out that it'd be in your best interest to move, maybe your best financial interest to move, but you're not sure. Well, gee, can I move and how? And could I co-locate with another station? Could we get, because this happens with FMs all the time. FMs are oftentimes clustered together in antenna farms where you get two or three or five or six FMs on the same tower. That's not unusual at all, especially in metropolitan areas. So, but it doesn't always occur to us as AM station engineers and owners that, well, we could actually put these two or three or maybe even four AM stations together. How does one get started thinking about that process?
Well, this happens a lot more than you think, and my phone rings a lot. We own a lot of towers. We own a lot of tower sites, and I pretty regularly get phone calls from AM owners who are in a situation just like we just talked about there, and they're wanting to know, could we study your, whatever call sign tower site for the purpose of co-locating with you because we're losing our site for whatever reason. And so that kind of thing happens a lot, but you don't have to co-locate with another AM. Recently, Hatfield and Dawson, I believe, they did a co-locate on a cellular tower. So you can do that. I have one in Detroit, Michigan, that is actually on a 1,000-foot FM TV tower. That has a skirt on it, and we feed that skirt, and it has some ground radials, and so you can do it on an FM tower. Some of the new AM rules have really relaxed the efficiency requirements, so it's not quite like you can load up a bed spring and see how that works, but you really do have an awful lot of options. And of course, some of those rule changes were really designed to give AM broadcasters some options in that regard.
Are there any options that would be unusual that may not have been unusual in the past, like some kind of a top loaded wire, between two telephone poles? Are there any unusual options one should think? You mentioned the cell tower, and I guess this would be another skirt fed. So any a vertical structure can be skirt fed in one way or another. Any other things that we should be thinking about?
I would say nearly everything's on the table. If it is vertical and radiates, I think you could probably make something happen if it had enough height. There are some other things that have been around a while, things that are normally used for travelers information services like Valcom WIPs. The FCC a year or so ago approved those for use above a certain frequency. I want to say 1240, but I could be wrong there. And literally you could, I could set one of those up out here in the yard and be on the air with it. And that would give somebody a real option. Of course, there's the Kinstar antenna we saw a few years ago. There's just all kinds of things. So, I think the best course of action is to stick with the conventional as much as possible, because it's going to be the most efficient. It's going to be the easiest to make work. It's going to give you the most signal for the amount of money you're putting into it and the amount of power you're driving it with and all of those things. But, if that's not possible, then you may have to think creatively.
I forgot about that Kinstar antenna from Kintronics. That's what, a pole in the middle and about four poles on the edges and with some horizontal wires going out to them, and they're fed in an interesting configuration, right?
That's right.
And then I was just right on the front of this radio guide, this HEBA antenna that Grady Motes has been working to, he's finished the engineering on, kind of figured out this was popular, or it was talked about 20 plus years ago. And I think it was an engineer, I want to say from Egypt, that was promoting it. And I don't think they had it quite figured out at the time. They knew they had something, but they didn't get it really, really dialed in. And I think Grady Motes has with some help from others, has really got this thing dialed in. And so that is an option right there. They're getting some, perfectly decent results out of that antenna design. Interesting. So we're going to talk about more of the mechanics of co-locating AM stations. How close can they be? How far can they be apart from each other on the dial if you want to put a couple stations together, or co-locate with other stuff? What do you have to worry about if you're putting your AM on a cell tower? That's coming up in just a few minutes. We're here with Chris Alexander. He's the Director of Engineering at Crawford Broadcasting Company. I'm Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. And our show is brought to you in part by my good friends at Broadcast Bionics. We'll be right back.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics. Designed to bring video to your audio content. Visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot, and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Adam GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good-spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16 GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
Thanks so much to Broadcast Bionics for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Go to bionic.radio to find out more about Camera One. What a cool system. They've been doing this for a long time and partners with a lot of things that we do over at Telos Alliance. All right, we're here with Chris Alexander, Director of Engineering at Crawford Broadcasting. Chris, take 30 seconds and tell us what Crawford Broadcasting is. We don't always hear about it, but you guys are a pretty stable company in the radio biz.
Yeah, we've been around since 1959. I haven't personally been with Crawford Broadcasting that long. I've been with them for almost 37 years now. Came on in 1984 into my present job. But we're kind of spread out. We're on both coasts and right down the middle. And I've lost count of the number of total stations. I think we have 36 total signals. Okay. On the air, something like that. I guess I should know that, shouldn't I?
Well,
sometime I asked Sam Wallington how many that EMF has. I'd like to see what he says.
I don't know if he has an exact count or not. They're kind of like, I'm not comparing EMF to weeds or daisies or dandelions, but they sure seem to spring up a whole lot of them.
They do. I think if we asked Sam that, he'd look at his watch and say, well, what time is it? You know,
let me run the growth algorithm and for this time of day, right. I'll tell you what it is. I got to say, one thing that I'm glad about EMF, we are, some of my stations in Mississippi are co-located on a tower with EMF. And when they bought an FM station that we kind of wanted to buy, but we didn't have the money to buy it. So they bought it, and they're not a direct competitor to any of our formats. And they seriously improved the transmitter site on their own, I guess at their own expense, because the tower owner wasn't going to improve it. And so EMF made a number of improvements right off the bat. And then the tower's gone through a couple of sales and somebody else owns it now. But anyway, they've been a very good co-tenant there. So yeah, that's always good.
Got a lot of friends over there. Great folks.
So, we've talked to Mark Persons about this a bit, but tell us what some of the important key factors are when you want to think about putting two AM stations on the same tower or towers. What technically, what do you have to worry about?
Well, I guess the number one thing is your allocation. What channel are you on and who do you have to protect? Are you going to be directional or non-directional? And if you can be non-directional, how much power can you run? And with that amount of power, can you cover the market that you want to cover? So those are your right up front questions. The one that I'm working on right now is a 1220 in Denver. Mm-hmm. The station has been on a lease tower right in the middle of Denver. I mean, you just couldn't pick a spot more in the center of geographic Denver. It's been there for a long, long time, and it's a tall tower, so it's essentially a kilowatt station, but it runs at 660 watts because of the efficiency of that tower to protect the other stations. And so it's non-directional right now, and it really covers the market well. Well, that tower, this is another situation where the land's worth more than the tower, and there's all sorts of issues there. So we've been given notice that at the end of our lease, we're going to have to find another place to go. I looked at the allocation, and I have protections south and I have protections north. They're not super tight, but they are of consideration. And of course, we already have three other tower sites in Denver, in the Denver area. And so they're the first place I looked. I mean, why go rent something if you've already owned something? Mm-hmm. We of course wanted the closest in tower site, and that had to be the KLZ tower site. KLZ is on 560 kilohertz. It's one of the old, the old regionals, mm-hmm. It covers a huge area. And it has two big 450 foot towers that are wide spaced, like 900 feet apart. And then, And if it was just that, we'd be, okay, well, let's just put another tower out there and we'll be good to go. The thing is, a few years ago, we did another co-location. And so I have my 810 station operating there with a four tower directional, none of them shared with KLZ. So we have two towers wide spaced, and then we have four. We have mama and papa and four babies in the middle. And so we already have two, and now I'm wanting to bring a 1220 in there as well. But from up there, I'm going to have to be a little bit directional to protect the stations to the north. So that means I can share one of those 810 towers, but I have to put up one more to achieve the protections that I need. So, you know, it's a complex thing and it's going to be some expense involved, but really the looking at all the other options for that particular radio station and the allocation, that's really about our only hope of keeping that particular station alive. It's it's a low power AM. It's it's not just worth a whole lot. And so, you know, there's a point of diminishing returns you reach very quickly. So moving it onto our own land is the thing that makes a lot of sense, and that's what we plan to do. But it's going to take some engineering to do it. But those are the questions that you have to ask and answer up front for any co-location. You really need to deal with the allocation.
I got to believe there comes a calculus where you wonder, do we turn this license in, or do we in fact relocate it, maybe at a lower power level? Maybe it's now maybe you have to make it non-directional where it was directional at a lower power. One of my stations in Mississippi years ago, we got away from a directional tower site that an ice storm had taken down like four of the five towers. And we ended up going non-directional at a lower power level, but still covering the market that we just couldn't say we were the most powerful station in the Mississippi Delta anymore. It really didn't matter. We were covering the city that we of financial interest. So you got to do this calculus. Do we want to be a lower power station? Keep the license, because who knows? Maybe there's some FCC benefit to hanging on to that AM license somewhere down the road. Maybe at some point, a pipe dream, but maybe they are able to migrate AM stations into the lower part of the FM band or something. Channel 6 area, maybe never ever happened, but it would be, I got to think there's some value in holding on the license instead of just turning it in like some stations have elected to do because they didn't really still had another choice.
Well, the obvious benefit is an FM translator.
Yeah.
So you can pair with the AM. Something that I'm seeing a lot of is, let's just say a station has multiple towers, like you said, and they decide let's take down two of the towers, let's keep one, we have to reduce our power to a non-directional, whatever the non-directional allocation would sustain, but it still covers the market, and we have a translator, and so that holding that AM license allows us to have that translator, and the translator then covers really what they want. And that, you know, the AM is the primary station, but the FM is what everybody's going to be listening to.
You know, so funny,
there's value there.
Yeah. This is exactly what we did in Greenville, Mississippi. We had a three tower directional array for 1330 AM. And we ended up going non-directional. Our nighttime power is just nil. It's very, very low. But we do have we have a translator, and the translator's right on the 1 a.m. tower. We've even sold off property that has one of the towers on it. Now, the new owner hasn't removed the tower yet, but he will. And then someday we'll take down the other tower. Right now, they're just floating. As long as we're on the a.m. topic, so we see that, you know, there's benefit perhaps in co-locating or come up with an interesting vertical radiator. What about, some years ago, we talked a bit about MDCL. In fact, we had a gentleman on from Alaska who talked about going with the MDCL modulation scheme, if you will, or power control scheme with AM stations. Saving money with MD. First of all, remind us what MDCL is and how does it work?
MDCL is what the FCC calls it, and it's a good acronym. Some people call it DCC for dynamic carrier control, but MDCL stands for modulation dependent carrier level. And essentially what it does is it reduces the carrier level of the AM with modulation. Now, it can go either way, and there's different algorithms that you can use, and you can then select different levels of compression. One of the algorithms, and I'm trying to remember what they are, but one of them reduces the carrier when there's silence. And then when there's when the modulation goes up, the carrier goes up. The one we use is called AMC. I wish I could remember what that stands for, but it does just the opposite. When the modulation goes silent, the carrier comes up. And we did a lot of tests early on, and I'm talking going back 10 years probably when we were first experimenting with this, and we had some equipment to do it with. We first experimented in the Bay Area with our station is actually located over in the Modesto area, so it's a ways from the Bay Area, but it's 50,000 watts and it puts a pretty good signal, 2 millivolt, 5 millivolt really over the Bay Area. But it's very expensive to operate. Power is very expensive out there. And so we wanted to experiment with this, and we did. But our concern was that will this compromise the signal in the fringe area? In this case, over in the Bay Area, will people notice that their signal's not as good as it used to be? And what we found was that the AMC, which restores the carrier at silence, it has a benefit in that it keeps the receiver's AGC voltage, it keeps it down, so that when you go silent, it doesn't suck up all this noise. And that's kind of what we found with the other one. So if the carrier goes away when the modulation goes silent, then your carrier drops to like half. And now all the AGCs in the radios, it sucks up everything, and you hear all the static and all the different, all the noise and so forth.
Yeah.
Benefits, are just incredible. We immediately, month this year to month last year, we saw a $1,000 savings in our electric bill. That's significant. And we've tracked that. We actually tracked that for a full year across that station, and then across others as we did it. Of course, that's on a 50 kilowatt station. You do this on your 10 or your 5, you're probably not going to see anywhere near that much of savings. But if you've got a 50 kilowatt station running full time, and you got a $10,000 electric bill, you reduce it by 10%. That's something.
Yeah, it is. What transmitters on the marketplace these days can do MDCL, maybe with a software or a software and hardware upgrade? I'm sure Nautel and Harris are probably the big proponents of that, right?
The only one I can speak to is Nautel, because it's what we use, and I'm really not familiar with what anybody else is using. But the Nautel, not only their NX series does it, but we actually have done it on their older transmitters, their ND series, by adding an IBOC exciter, because that's built into that functionality is built into the IBOC exciter. Of course we run IBOC on most of our AMs anyway. So we had that already in place. It was just a software upgrade, but I guess what I'm saying is any transmitter that'll take a mag and a phase input, you should be able to add an outboard, like a Nautel AM IBOC and switch on the MDCL and be off to the races. You just have to notify the FCC that you're doing it.
And I'm sorry, I said Harris. I should have said Gates Air, but I do believe I've talked to people who have Gates Air or maybe older Harris transmitters, and they were doing MDCL as well. It's interesting that you picked the it makes sense to me. You picked the algorithm, the scheme that when you have dead air, it increases the carrier to full to keep the quieting proper for your listeners, helps your listeners. But that's an incentive to not have dead air, isn't it?
It is an incentive not to have dead air. The advantage of the other one is that it maintains the same PEP power. whereas you actually reduce your PEP power by the amount of the, by 50% of the carrier with the one we're using. So you're really not putting out as much peak power. But the thing is, the power that you're not putting out doesn't do anything for you.
Right.
It's just a carrier. It's not carrying any information. So it really is wasted power.
You want the power in the sidebands is what we always said for AM, because that's where the audio comes from. But it reminds me of the old days of NTSC television with analog transmission. You know how the station would go to black, the power of the transmitter would go to max. And and so the oftentimes the person writing the check to the electrician would say, can we not go to black very often? If you're going to go to black, can you put a slide up that's white or something?
It'd be interesting to have. You always get the sync buzz in the audio too when it went black, because the power would go way up.
That's right. That's right. You should have a somebody will do it. You know, have a Raspberry Pi that figures out for every second of dead air on an MDCL transmitter with the algorithm you're running, it costs you this much extra. There's a little counter of dollars that go up because you got dead air.
Well, another thing that we found with this, and this is a real consideration, is your auxiliary transmitter. Suppose you have MDCL on your main and something goes wrong with it. You have to do maintenance. It's down, whatever. And you go to your aux and, you run on your aux for maybe an hour or two while you're fixing the main, and you put the main back on the air and you think all is well. And then here comes the electric bill at the end of the month and you fall out of your chair because that $1,000 is back in there. And you go, what on earth? I mean, I just ran the thing for an hour. Well, guess what? You set that demand on your meter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they bill that demand by the kilowatt. And so what we made it a policy is we would run our auxes at 50% power. That way we would not push that demand up. Since then, pretty much all of our auxes also have MDCL. So it's not a factor for us anymore. But that was a pretty hard lesson to learn, and it'll sneak up on you. You don't know. You don't think about it.
You're in these markets where you got full power auxes anyway. But the stations I took care of, if we were lucky enough to have an aux, it was a kilowatt, whereas the main was 50 kilowatts. So it wasn't a factor for us. Yeah. Hey, it's This Week in Radio Tech, our 545th episode. I'm Kirk Harnack. We're talking to Chris Alexander this hour, and I'm delighted that Chris could be with us. He's a hands-on engineer, and he talks almost daily with his engineers out in the field in different markets across the U.S. and just really keeps a real handle on what's going on. So it's great. We got some more topics to talk about coming up, including the telco abandoning POTS. What do you do? Finding broadband alternatives at your transmitter site. And in fact, we're going to hear about that in a second. And site security in these days when, there are gangs out there looking for what you got. Well, we're going to talk about that coming up. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you in part by Josh Bone and our friends over at Max Connect Wireless. We got a testimonial here from John Tocock. We'll be right back.
With all of the recent cybersecurity attacks against large corporations, we were looking for a product that would give us the ultimate in security at our transmitter sites and as well as with our broadcast equipment. Max Connect fits the bill very well. Its greatest security feature is the fact that it gives you a single static IP address. Using this single static IP address allows us to close hundreds of open ports on our firewalls across the company and restrict access to only the Max Connect IPs. This has greatly reduced our exposure to the World Wide Web and made us much more secure moving forward. It's also given us the ability to expand as needed in a secure fashion.
I'm loving these things. My radio stations are in small towns, and we have internet at our stations that is not exactly reliable. They tell us, well, a backhoe, caught our fiber along the Mississippi River. Well, don't you have another feed? No, it's the only feed that feeds the whole town. Max Connect has saved our bacon at our studios several times, providing backup internet service. Really appreciate Josh Bone and Max Connect Wireless.com. You can choose your carrier if you have a favorite carrier, one that you know is strong in your area. You can even get a 4G LTE modem that has two SIM cards in it. And remember, it's not the modem, it is the service that makes the big difference there with prioritized data. This Week in Radio Tech is also brought to you in part by my buddies over at Angry Audio. Don't get mad, get angry. And they are experts at Studio Hub. Why? Because they own it, they bought it. Everything Studio Hub is theirs. and they're developing more new products. In fact, okay, check this out. Now, would you need something like this? Maybe so. Here's a female XLR. That's hard. There you go. Female XLR. And on the other side of this is an RJ45. Now, this would be great for either mono audio, because this is one female XLR, or it'd be good for AES-EBU audio. This is going to get your audio from an AES-EBU output on a device into the world of Cat5 cable. And you can run that easily, low voltage cable, wherever you want to go, but probably to the back of your node or your blade or whatever audio over IP device that you're going into, because those devices tend to use RJ45 connectors. And then here's another version of it. It's got the male XLR on the other end. And there, so again, good for mono analog or good for AES-EBU. And if you just want to spend some money to hook two RJ45s together, you can do it that way. I wouldn't do that. Cables in all sorts of sizes. Here's a pre-made cable with an RJ45 at one end and a couple of female XLRs there. And of course, the ones that I like are these, the ones that you use whatever length of Cat5 cable that you want. And, this may be a little bit more elegant for some folks. I just like the flexibility of having this dongle at the back side of the equipment that I'm hooking to, and then use whatever length of Cat5 cable that I want to get to. It comes in male and female XLRs. You can get bare wires. You can get RCA plugs that would be unbalanced. You can also get a quarter-inch tip ring sleeve connectors on there. So all the usual Studio Hub stuff, and they're developing new items as well. So you need to go to angryaudio.com and check out the Studio Hub tab. But this is one of the new items that they have. Now, not many radio stations are probably going to use this device, but recording studios and other audio places may. It just depends on what you need to do. It's got all RJ45s across the back here. And these come in a couple varieties, some wired for stereo left-right audio, some wired for AES-EBU. And there's even a version here that's wired to the AES-72 Type 4E standard, which is four AES-EBUs on one RJ45 jack. And that brings you to four of the XLR connectors on the front. These are available with all male, all female, half female. There's several different varieties for this panel from Studio Hub. It's an XLR breakout panel from Studio Hub. Check it out. Go to angryaudio.com and you can find out about all their different products there, including the Bluetooth audio gadget, the headphone amps, the gizmos, the gadgets. They got a lot of cool stuff there. So check it out. Angryaudio.com. All right. I'm Kirk Harnack along with Chris Alexander. On This Week in Radio Tech, it's our 545th episode. Chris, oh man, what are we going to get to next here? Fire mitigation.
Let me tell you that my executive producer texted me during the break and said AMC stands for Amplitude Modulation Compounding. C-O-M-P-A-N-D-I-N-G. So anyway, now we all know what it means. I'm not sure that helps a lot, but anyway, before we go into the next topic, I thought I'd throw that in.
I'm glad we circled back and put a period on that. Now we know what it is. Good deal. All right. Fire mitigation. You were telling me that at the place you are now at the Alexander compound on top of Old Smoky there in Colorado, you had some close calls with fire. And of course we saw transmitter sites get burned up in California in the last year or two. Talk to us about fire mitigation.
Oh yeah. We had a close call here last October. Some of you folks probably saw the East Troublesome Fire in the news. And how it was just a huge fire, and it came not quite to the property line here, but pretty close, and then turned north just by God's grace that it went north and around us, and so we're kind of on an oasis here of green. Everything looks fine here, and so we got a lot of critters in here, including mountain lions and bears and everything else. It seems like we've got in here because it's where everything's still green. But, California has been our big fire challenge. Everybody's seen the news reports. Everybody knows how dry it's been out there. Of course, we went through a fire in 2007 on Catalina Island that was just devastating. We eventually moved to the mainland. And we're on a mainland site now on a mountaintop in Orange County, in the very, very eastern part of Orange County. But, you know, we're all the time thinking about fire, constantly, and for good reason, because you know, really from middle of June through the end of the year, this time it went right on through the top of the year, on into like January, when there was a fire nearby nearly constantly. And they were doing power shutoffs because of the nearby fires. You know, you have to look at a transmitter site and you have to see, okay, if a fire, you don't say if, you say when the fire comes through here, what's going to happen? How is it going to behave? What's going to, you know, and what can I do to mitigate that? You know, and so you want that fire to run through there on the ground quickly without damaging anything critical. And so that particular site, KBRT, when we built it in 2012, we built it for fire. So there's very little in the way of combustibles there on the site. But we still have a big responsibility, and we keep that grass mowed, you know, and it's 35 acres, and it, you know, we have a tractor and a brush hog, and we have a great team there on the payroll that take care of that and keep it down. And then they keep it even more down under the guy anchors, you know, because you can really damage that metal if it gets really good and hot. We had that happen on Catalina. When it comes up to a fence, say the fence around your tower base, we use a fence with a PVC non-conductive coating, and that probably won't burn, but it'll sure melt. And it'll make a big mess, and I really don't want to deal with that. So we keep a vegetation-free zone about 3 feet either side of the fence. But you just look at every little thing, and you have to maintain it. You have to stay on it. This year, this last fire season, I should say, I kept being bothered by our transmitter building roof. We bought a prefab. If you think a cellular site, it's that kind of building, has the aggregate siding on it, you know, and then the top of it it's really just a plywood deck with a membrane on it. And I kept thinking that, you know, if an ember were to fly in here on the wind and land on that, it would melt through that membrane and it could set that plywood on fire. So I saw a vulnerability. So this year we put a metal lid on that building. So anyway, those are the kind of things in fire country that you really have to think about. You also have to think about your infrastructure. What happens when the fire comes through and it burns up the power poles? And it will. You know, it's going to take them a while to get that fixed, maybe days, maybe weeks. What are you going to do? Do you have a generator? Do you have fuel? When the Forest Service or whoever won't, the fire authority won't let you in for weeks on end, you know, what are you going to do? And so those are all things that you have to think about in fire country.
You mentioned vegetation-free spaces around fences and around guy anchor points. You said 3 feet. Is that enough? Or what kind of space do you try to get between forest or brush and things that you don't want to catch on fire at all?
Well, I don't want any trees on the property. I can tell you that right now. You know, and I can't exactly go on my neighbor's land and start cutting down trees to get more space. But my our property doesn't really have much of any tree by anything by the way of trees on it. Because those are the things when they catch fire, they torch and then the embers are carried away. And then that's what sets spot fires ahead of the fire and propagates it. And that's what you really don't want. Is 3 feet enough? Well, you know, we keep the grass very short on either side, and so it probably is. I'll let you know after the fire goes through there. But, you know, if you make it a whole lot more than that, I mean, these fence lines can be pretty long, and it's a chore to keep them 100% vegetation-free. You know, I mean, stuff grows up, and you've got to be constantly pulling it. You don't really want to spray it. You got to pull it. You don't want it to die and then be a dead standing fuel ready to go there. So, you know, it's a lot of work. So, you know, we could increase that area, but it would really add to a lot, what's already a lot of work.
You, You mentioned telco abandonment of legacy services, and I'm sure I've heard of people saying, hey, they're cutting off our T1 service, or certainly we can't get ISDN anymore, and then they're cutting off what we have, or they've raised the price to, I've heard of $700 a month ISDN that used to be $70 a month. How do you deal with telco abandoning their legacy services? And I'm thinking the answer is IP, but anyway, you tell me what you're doing.
Well, you're exactly right. The answer is IP, but we have dealt with this. It kind of hit us. It kind of blindsided us. And believe it or not, the first place we saw it really was Ciptron. I mean, who would have thought that? Is that a legacy service? Well, here's the thing. These carriers are really pushing people to move to cloud-based service. And so if you have a premise-based phone system, like we do in most of our operations, we have telco rack with phone equipment in it. It's an internet service that then carries the SIP trunk or trunks into it. And then we do what we want with it internally in terms of, stations and analog lines and whatever else we want to do with that. But they're really getting away from that. And I am told authoritatively that within the next 3 years, we're going to see the big manufacturers like, Avaya and, others, that they're going to stop manufacturing premise-based systems and forcing you over into the, cloud-based things. And so, the way that they hit us was, like you said, a huge price increase. And by huge, I mean like a sixfold price increase. Mm. And they gave us a deadline and, we were just stunned by it. We've seen this with POTS lines. What do you think, Kirk, would be a reasonable price to pay for a POTS line at a transmitter site? You use it to call the manufacturer, or, your remote control calls out on it, or you call in and the remote control answers. Very little use. What do you think a POTS line?
In Mississippi, we actually just canceled three POTS lines at three transmitter sites because we were able to get IP there. And for our older sign systems remote control that want POTS, we just put a POTS adapter in. But we were paying $80-$90 bucks a month for each of those POTS lines, which didn't seem out of line. It's a lot, but now we're saving $260 bucks a month or so from those three sites. What were they wanting for you?
In Birmingham, Alabama, not too far, right down I-65 from you there, our AT&T bill for a POTS line at a transmitter site suddenly went from that level up to $540 a month.
Gee.
$540. And then at another site, it did the same thing. At another site, the same thing. Before long, all five of our sites are in the $500 to $600 a month range for these gold-plated POTS lines that get very little use, and we can't stomach that. So, IP is your option, but you got to find it, And a lot of times, transmitter sites, it's really not all that available.
I know everybody's situation is different. We've been very lucky in Mississippi and Arkansas, an area that's not well served by ISPs, but we have a relationship with a wireless ISP that covers most of the same area that all 12 of our stations do. And so they get tower space from us and we get internet service. And it's not always 1,000% reliable. They're a small ISP. They don't get the full attention of the providers that they're with. And sometimes, power goes out, batteries die at a hop point. Generally speaking, it works. And that's how we get phones. And two of our stations have on-air programming, one via a couple of Zip Ones codecs and one via the Omnia MPX node carrying FM MPX to a transmitter site. So, it's been a symbiotic relationship. And I would encourage people that you can either do your own, IP radio link, or you can partner with a wireless ISP.
You need to do both and, because your wireless your own wireless link is going down. Just a matter of time. It's going to, we have those Part 101 links all over every place. And, but they do go down. You have a big storm come through, and it can go down. And you need reliable telephone security, you name it, at the transmitter site. And so, yes, wireless ISP is a good option. It's not universally available. Other places you can get a cable drop. But a lot of times they're not going to want to bring it all the way to your building, and they'll give you some huge, a quote on a huge price to do the construction to bring it to your building. Mm-hmm. So we're really getting creative, having them do a drop to a NEMA box that we mount just inside our property, on a couple of poles, and then they put their modem and so forth inside it. And then we use like a Ubiquiti link or something to shoot that over to our building a few hundred feet away. There's all kinds of things like that you can do, but you just got to be creative. You got to think outside the box, because otherwise you're going to be paying $500-$600 for a POTS line. You could be paying, we had some T1 lines in Chicago, and they went up to like $3,000 a month each. We had to bail out of those. So, you're going to be facing those kind of things, and you're going to have to be proactive, and you have to be really creative, think outside the box.
I kind of understand companies like AT&T and other providers wanting to get away from the myriad of kind of specialized products that they have that they supplied for decades. If your business plan could be, we're going to supply IP, and that's all we're going to supply. We're going to quit supplying the stuff that requires specialized copper this or copper that or end devices or booster devices along the way. We're going to quit supplying that. I may not like it, but I get it. And since now we can do almost anything we want to do over IP, of course, some engineers will complain, and I get it, that, well, IP is not reliable at our transmit or at our studio or at our transmitter site. Well, a friend of the show here, a guy named Dave Anderson, I used to engineer for a group of Christian stations down in Florida. At his studio, he had four sources of internet, and one of them was a 4G modem, but other one, he had four sources and a router that would handle that. And then at each of his transmitter sites, he made sure he had two sources of internet, even if one of them was an LTE modem. And even if one of them was, let's say they couldn't, just like you said, couldn't get a cable drop at the transmitter site, they'd find out, well, how far away can we get a cable drop? Oh, there's a mom and pop grocery store there. Well, let's go talk to them. Hey, how would you like free internet? We'll pay for your internet if you'll let us put a little tower in the back of your house here and shoot that to our transmitter site. And he said that's where, it's trouble to set up, but it works. It's worked out. And I know it may not be the reliability factor that a, major broadcaster like Crawford would want to have, but all these things can be part of an overall plan.
That's right. And you got to be, you need N plus one. Yeah. Meaning however many feeds that you need plus one. So you have something to go back, fall back on and really those. And I think satellite internet it has not been good to us over the years. We tried to use it on Catalina Island after the fire and it really didn't work very well. It had huge latency issues and that was HughesNet. And that was 2007, a long time ago.
Yeah.
But there are like Viasat. They'll give you a static IP address, and they claim their latency is in the 2-digit milliseconds. We can live with that.
Well, and with SpaceX,
putting up some. Yeah, they're getting ready to. They're launching a network, so those may be some real options for us as secondary or tertiary, feeds for IP feeds or primary if you just can't do anything else.
I've got one studio site in very rural Mississippi. Interesting thing though, it's the number one radio station in the county, which, I don't know, may not be saying a lot, but okay, it is. And I swear the DSL comes in on the top two wires of a barbed wire fence. It's just awful. Hey, site security. This is kind of an issue when people are, oh my goodness, people are hooked on all kinds of bad drugs and they want money, and some people are just willing to take and steal anybody else's stuff to get it. how is this causing you a problem, and how are you addressing it?
Cameras. We put cameras like crazy, and cameras are very good now. They're really not that expensive, and we're rolling our own. We are buying these 5 megapixel or 4K IP cameras. We have tracking dome cameras or tracking PTZ cameras that, and I mean, it really works. Somebody comes in and, you know, that thing picks it up and it locks on and it will follow them. And of course it's recording it, you know, and you can see what it is they're up to and all of that. And they're dual mode. They work very well at night with no light whatsoever. And then we've augmented that with infrared floodlights in key areas. No one knows it's there, but it's very, very bright, you know, if you're looking at the camera. So we do an awful lot of that. Of course, there's motion detection on this.
Yeah.
At some sites, we have Doppler. We have Doppler coverage of the whole site. So, you know, and we get a lot of nuisance trips, deer coming through there or coyote or mountain lion or whatever. We get some interesting video to go look at when it sets off the system. But we've also seen, you know, somebody that shouldn't be in there come walking in the dark of night, and they take a few steps inside the fence and suddenly strobes start going off and sirens start going off. And then we see them turn around and hoof it back over the fence. So, you know, you can't, unless you've got, you know, an armed force that lives there all the time, you know, you can't really protect it, but you can take steps that will really discourage, you know, those kind of things. I think that's a really good way to go. And again, you can roll your own. And, you know, if you're so inclined, you buy the DVR, you buy these IP cameras, they literally plug into it. They have the DVR has PoE outputs. You buy whatever size hard drives you want. And if you have IP connectivity at the site, you can look at it, control it, play it back, you know, do whatever you want to do there.
I want to know if you've got any pictures of Sasquatch.
Haven't seen that. We've seen some other weird stuff though. We really have. We've seen mountain lions hanging around there, and that kind of gives you a little bit of pause, and you think, you know, I was out at that tower just the other night, and I wonder where that kitty cat was.
Hopefully off sleeping somewhere.
Hope so. Yes.
So I, at my own transmitter sites, about 2 years ago, I tried some really cheap Chinese cameras that had their own app. I'm sure the video went to China first before it came back. I'm sure. And then they dropped the app. And so the cameras were no good to us whatsoever. Didn't matter how cheap they were.
Right.
So, and I like that you've rolled your own. I haven't had time to experiment with different brands of cameras. I like the RioLink setup. I like their quality. We just put a bunch of Wyze cams at transmitter sites. We got the PTZ ones. We really don't need it, the PTZ ones. But the only thing I don't like about the Wyze cams is they're Wi-Fi only. And so I had to go install at my sites. I typically don't have Wi-Fi. So I went and the sites that didn't have it, I had to go put a cheap Wi-Fi hotspot. There's no Ethernet jack on the back of them. So you have to Wi-Fi to them. And I don't have any outdoors yet. These are just indoors. But here's something else I found. Most of our sites have LED overhead lights instead of fluorescent. And we have one site where somebody, this is the shared site. This is the site that's shared with EMF. And some caretaker has been in there and shut the lights off. And so it's the only one that's not in color. The other ones, we just leave the lights on because they're LED lights. They're so cheap nowadays to run. And we get full color pictures there. Any thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, and I tell you, we don't leave the lights on, and I'll tell you why. Bugs.
Yes.
Bugs love lights, and if there's a pinhole anywhere in your exterior envelope, those lights will draw them in like crazy. So we just go with the infrared mode, and the bugs don't respond to that, and we're pretty good. So, yeah, we don't leave the lights on.
Good point. And we've been fairly bug free up to this moment in Mississippi, but it is Mississippi. It's about to change. Yeah. We know Mississippi is a bowl of moisture and bugs. So,
yes,
hey, we got one more quick, We got one more quick break to make, and then Chris, you know, I'm going to surprise you. I'm sorry, I didn't brief you on this. We're looking for a tip of the week, something that you'd like to share. Maybe one of your engineers who writes in the local oscillator, some tip that it could be a website, could be a tool, could be something a great deal from Harbor Freight. I don't know, or just a procedure that you guys find to be valuable throughout Crawford Broadcasting that you'd like to share with other engineers. So if you would be thinking on that for about 2 minutes, it's This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Alexander, with the Director of Engineering at Crawford Broadcasting. They've got 30-some stations all across the U.S., and their engineers do a write-up every month in a little paper called The Local Oscillator. I believe that is available to people who want it, and I get it every month. It's full of great ideas, and just let you know what challenges engineers are dealing with and how they're coming up with ways to solve it. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends over at Broadcaster General Store, where you can get Vox Pro. Let's hear about it.
Hey, what's happening? St. John here, coming to you from Command Central, and wanted to tell you about the absolute best partner you can have in radio. I'm talking about, boom, Wheatstone's Vox Pro. Lots of different audio software out there. Why Vox Pro? It's the only software designed to do what we needed to do, which is record, edit, playback in real time. When I say lightning fast, I'm going to show you how fast you can edit stuff up in Vox Pro right now. Literally three clicks on the controller, mark left, mark right, everything that gets marked, you hit delete, it goes away. It's literally that fast. So we're going to take this part right here. Boom. From caller 9 to him saying, I'm ready.
Five. You're ready for that secret sound.
Boom. All of that stuff. Hit delete. It goes away. Here's your edit.
You are tackling secret sound, caller 9.
I'm ready, St. John.
So one of the best features of version 7, this is awesome. It's effects macros, and you can literally put a chain of effects together so that instead of having to normalize a phone bit and then use noise reduction on it and EQ it and all that, you can literally build a chain. One button, this one's called call right here, I just click that. All of those processes happen instantaneously. Final thing that I love about Vox Pro, and there's so much more to get into, but one of my favorite things, you can load it on a laptop. I've literally done my show from a hotel room in Armenia to the conference room at, yeah, this was fun, jury duty. Great thing, no one could tell the difference. Vox Pro makes it totally easy. Telling you, if you're looking for the best on-air partner, call my friends at Wheatstone, ask them about Vox Pro, and you will be glad you did.
I wonder if St. John voted guilty or not from the jury room. Vox Pro is available at Broadcaster's General Store. You can go to their website at bgs.cc, or, you know, they are really set up well to handle your phone calls. So many places today don't want to hear from you on the phone because it takes up their time. Well, BGS is different. Broadcaster's General Store would love to hear from you at 352-622-7700. That's 352-622-7700 for Broadcaster's General Store. They have the time to talk to you. All right. We are just about finished with This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Alexander is our guest. And Chris, I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but I forgot once again to brief you on the fact that we'd like a tip of the week. Can you help us out?
I can.
Oh, good.
And this is something I haven't personally seen, but it's something that was discovered by one of our excellent engineers in Birmingham. And it is it's an app. It's called Paessler, Paessler, PRTG Network Monitoring. And it's an app you can have on your phone. I think there's a PC app as well. And it's free, and you can monitor free up to 100 devices SNMP. And you can have this and just carry it around with you and have it keeping an eye on transmitters, transmitter sites, microwave links, whatever it is, and just have it right there on your phone. And it's really an amazing thing. And I'll tell you what, folks, if you want to go to our website, which is crawfordmediagroup.net, and then you click on the About link and then go to Engineering and scroll down, you'll find all the the last few years anyway of the Local Oscillator. And in the April issue, you'll find a write-up about this. And we're going to have in the coming months, I don't know if we're going to get this probably in the August issue, we'll have a full write-up on it in Radio World Engineering Extra. But this is the kind of thing you can have on your hip and, you know, on your phone there, and suddenly a codec stops pinging or responding to a ping, mm-hmm. and you know, ooh, I got a problem. The codec at the, you know, at the FM site is not responding, and you know about it long before your phone starts ringing, and you know, you can jump on there and deal with it. So anyway, Pacler PRTG network monitoring.
I've used this before, and it's great. And I tried to use it before I knew anything about SNMP, and so it monitored a few things for me. In fact, I think it'll monitor stuff. It'll, if you have devices that throw off alarms using syslog, I think Pacler does that as well, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure it does. So syslog or SNMP.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but Todd's mm-hmm. going to tell us all about it. And he did a pretty good write-up there in the April oscillator. So anyway.
This is the very last local oscillator, right?
Well, two ago, the April issue, May issue.
Oh, the April one. Okay.
Yeah.
I will put a link to that in the show notes so people can find that easily. And thank you for making those local oscillator editions available online. I had forgotten that they were available online. I get mine in the email. Thank you. But that's really, boy, there's a lot of good stuff saved back in there. Yeah. Thank you so much. All right.
Yeah, the whole idea behind that is to share information, you know. And we share a lot of stuff, and then we hear from folks, too, and it's all very helpful.
Chris, thank you very much for being our guest today. I express my humble gratitude to you. I know that you had a busy day, and you've got more to do as soon as we sign off here. So hope you get things right. Fixed. Hey, who could be better at it than you know, Director of Engineering Dad? And Amanda's good with this kind of stuff too. So you got a crack team there.
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, my wife, and not just my wife, but other people, what they tell me is if I can't figure something out, they say, ask your daughter. So she's become my go-to. I just ask her and she figures it out, including how to get me on here where we can be on, you know, she sat near and worked for a while to get everything working. So we owe Amanda Hopp a debt of gratitude for getting us on today.
We know I've asked you to ask her about being a guest on the show, and she hasn't been real excited about that. I think she's a little shy.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Well, maybe you can convince her someday, because we'd love to have her be a guest on the show as well.
Yeah, maybe if we do it together, she would do it. Well, I'll have to ask her.
Yeah, so. You can hold her hand.
And then when she's not looking, I'll get up and leave.
Great. Oh, Chris, thank you so much. And these are great items for our show notes. So go to the show notes and look in there. Chris Alexander, Director of Engineering, Crawford Broadcasting. Thank you, sir. Appreciate you being here. And I'll send you some links about the show later on. Oh, hang on. Don't hang up yet, because we got to take a picture. Our show's been brought to you in part by some great sponsors. Go to them. Let them know about This Week in Radio Tech. Please tell your friends. If you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe. Got to do that. And you hit the little bell and get notified when there's a new This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks to Suncast, the producer of the show. Really appreciate the great job that he does every week. And thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, home of lots of great podcasts. We got to go. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.